Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
And now I'd like to introduce our 10-minute speaker, Ralph.
My name is Ralph, and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is April 11th, 1988. I'm long history of alcoholism in my family, and it took me a long time to get settled into AA because I didn't have a lot of structure in my life. I was a chef for a while, and I drank a real lot. But finally, I got 3 WDIs and got put in court-mandated a halfway house. And the counselor was a wonderful counselor. And she asked me what I wanted, if I could change anything in my life or about me. What I said, I wish my hair hadn't fallen out. I love this program. It really saved my life, literally. And every 5 years, I kind of like start feeling like I really despise this program. You know, I feel like I've lost touch with it, and things like dried up, and it's nothing that I'm getting out of it anymore or anything. And then after a while, something will trigger me, and I was like, you know, like sometimes it's, you know, I think about like when I 12-stepped my father, it's like that like woke me up, and you know, and I was like, oh, this is why I'm here, you know. And but when I go through those dry patches, it's difficult to come out of them. And so I'm in one of those right now. And it's a good time for me to come and speak because of it. And I've just started a 90 and 90, which I've never done before, to help me to stay into the program. And I mean, I've been to so many meetings in so many places, and I got, you know, after today, I got news, one of my sister's husbands, drunken husband, was put in prison for 25 years for shooting somebody. All of the women in my family married alcoholics, yeah, it's just so pervasive throughout my life with almost every member of my family. And I'm the first to get away from it. This program is so beautifully matched to not only just religion, but caring of people. And is sometimes I have a hard time letting people care for me. And it comes and goes. I know, you know, I always can tell to myself that if I'm feeling like it's getting old, I need to change what I'm doing. So, I, you know, there's been a lot of sorrow in my life, and I'm, you know, I'm having a little trouble cognitively, because I have HIV dementia, and I'm trying to keep myself from isolating by coming out in public and talking about it, instead of being afraid of being shunned. And I hope I can do that for the rest of my life, come into the halls and talk about what's happening to me and be comfortable with it. And that's what this program is able to do with me, or for me. And one thing I wish I miss the most is having sponsees. With having some cognitive difficulty, it's hard to have a sponsee. If I worry about meeting from them, I'm missing a a meeting. If I say I'm going to meet you at this meeting, if I forget to go there, you know, that's not being a very good sponsor. So, you know, it's just a struggle. It's a struggle. It's simply is that. And I would love to, you know, sponsor a newcomer. But I don't think that would be fair to them. And I mean, there's all kinds of things. I mean, I did some crazy things when I was young. I mean, when I grew up in Massachusetts, and for 1 year, Massachusetts had the drinking age at 18. And my older sister was buying alcohol for me. She was going, I was in middle school. And my sister, then, you know, she was old enough to get liquor. And so she was buying me liquor when I was 13. And also what my family didn't know for a long time is my brother was in the mafia in Miami, there's a yacht. Okay.
About 2 minutes.
Okay. So anyhow, he got busted, and they left a bale of marijuana in the barn behind our house, and the FBI came, and luckily the FBI agent in that area married my older sister. And they just let it go. They just let it go. Because they could have taken my whole, our whole house and everything. And I was really lucky. We were very lucky that they didn't take our house and property and everything. But it goes through my family forever. And so thank you for being here.
All right, now Lee is going to speak for as much or as little as she wants between now and
8 o'clock.
Okay.
5 till.
Okay. I'm Lee, alcoholic.
Hi, Lee.
And I don't know a soul in this room except for David, who asked me to speak tonight. I live in San Francisco. So this is a little, I'm always nervous anyway, but now I'm really wicked nervous. So you can tell it from the East Coast because I just said that. And I am. I'm from upstate New York and Boston, the Catskill Mountains. And my sobriety date actually is December 23rd, 1990. So I have 24 years and a little over 5 months. And I hope to God that and I will have 25 years in December. Yes. So, I grew up with parents who We're in the Depression, and can you guys hear me?
Yeah.
Cool. A little louder? Okay. My parents were in the Depression, and my father was in World War II for 4 years. So they both were pretty, let's say, dysfunctional. My father had PTSD, which they didn't know what that was back then, and he abused my brother and I, had a horrible temper. Both my parents were alcoholics. My mom was a daily drinker, and my father was a periodic drinker, which I didn't find out until I got sober, actually. So that's another little hidden thing that I didn't know about. I started drinking when I was 16 and immediately got drunk and had my first blackout. So that should have told me something right there. But, of course, I had many more years to play. So I grew up in a really small town. And all you did for drinking was you went to a field somewhere. And you just had a big bonfire and you just drank Boone's Farm, apple wine, and all that crap that used to, I don't even know if it's around anymore, back in the 60s and 70s. Yes, I'm older. And then I went off to college and ran into all kinds of drugs. Like, if somebody went through the 70s, I can't believe they didn't try one drug. Because there was a shitload of drugs back then. Things like Black Beauties, which are speed, and all kinds of acid, and, plus you always drank first and then did something else afterwards, right? Some pot or whatever. So I dove right in. I went to a 2-year college, and pretty much partied with everybody else, but I didn't realize that I was an alcoholic. Had no clue, because everybody else was partying like I was. So then I moved to Boston, and that's where I really, really got really just partied like crazy. And back then it was a big feminist movement in Boston. And of course I would we had to party. We had good reasons to party all the time. And I still regret this, and I write it in my 4-step all the time, is that I went through grad school in Boston drunk, which I don't know if anybody can relate to that, but I wasn't the best person in school. And then at the last semester, I decided not to go to 2-for-1s and drink and do drugs. I did really well in school. How about that? But I still regret not being awake for half my classes. And at the time, when I was a senior in college, actually, my father died suddenly. I was 21 and he was 50. Of a heart attack Thanksgiving night. So that gave me lots of excuses to drink and do more drugs. You know, we don't deal with our feelings, right? So especially something like that, I just smoked pot and drank and did everything there was. I can't deal with having more time. I don't know what else to do. I decided that I'm a clinical social worker, so I worked with kids for a long, long time. And I was labeled a periodic alcoholic, which, for people who don't know what that is, I used to drink on weekends only. I'd work during the week, deal with the emotionally disturbed, sexually, physically abused kids. And then on Friday, I said, oh, my God, I had such a horrible week. I really deserve to get drunk. So I'd go out to the bars. I was a bar drinker. I never drank at home. Well, not never, but I usually didn't drink at home. I didn't usually buy alcohol or anything in the house. But I went out Friday, Saturday night, regrouped on Sunday, went back to work on Monday, and did the same thing over and over and over again. But I found myself getting into more trouble, going into darker and deeper places in the city for drugs, hanging out with people that you hang out with when you're using, right? And I actually decided I had to leave a relationship. And that's an when you move?
Geographic.
Thank you. I told you I was old. I had to do a geographic, so I went back to New York. This woman that I was a partner with was abusing me. And I've actually had three partners that have abused me. And I just don't pick them very well, obviously. So I went back to New York, did some more work, and really, that was bad. So I decided to move again for another geographic to Los Angeles, because that's where my brother was. And I thought, well, maybe I can get closer to my brother, but that's actually never happened. He is not one of us. And I wish he was, because then he would understand what's going on in the world. So I got sober in Los Angeles in 1990. But who the hell has a December 23rd, 2 days before Christmas, sober date? You know, that's a little weird. But I didn't pick it. The partner that I had at the time was going out with someone else and behind my back, and I just found out right before Christmas, and we were supposed to go back to Chicago to see family back there, and of course that never happened. I was partying for like 2 days straight, which is very unusual for me. I'm a periodic. Went to a whole bunch of Christmas parties, didn't eat for 2 days. And I remember sort of foggy, remember people telling me that I shouldn't drive home. Now, if you know anything about Los Angeles, the valley, I lived in Los Feliz and the valley's on the other side of the hill. So I had about a half an hour, 20 minutes to drive back home. Of course, I decided I knew better, right? And I was going to drive home. And I got to a ramp that goes onto the 5, the 5 freeway. And I also had a huge bag of pot with me that a friend of mine had given me that was homegrown in my glove compartment. So I stop at the light. I'm like waiting for it to go green. It probably went green like 5 times. But I turn left and I go up to the ramp, but I don't make it. I had one of the poles that's by the ramp. And I was only going like 5 miles an hour, but I thought. But what happened is I hit the whole bottom right side of my car was just down. I mean, I must have hit it just right, and the whole thing was dragging on the ground. But I didn't know this. So I'm sitting there thinking, should I call for AAA to give me a lift or whatever? Especially since I got this pot in my car, and I thought, now what the hell? I'm only like 5 miles away from my house. I'll drive home, right? So this is right before Christmas. I get on the freeway, and I'm going 40 miles an hour with my hazard lights on, and, you know, that's just somebody waiting to happen, right? I look over, and there's sparks flying all over. I'm looking at the passenger side, and there's all these sparks, and it's from the bottom of my car hitting the freeway. And I thought, well, that's fun. What's that? So, of course, I'm a mile away. The sign says Los Feliz, and I get pulled over. Like 6-12 cops, and the thing is, I passed every single alcohol test that they gave me. Every single one. God knows how I did that. But anyway, they thought I hit a car. But I kept telling them, no, I just hit a pole. They didn't believe me, right? Yeah. So I get back to the jail, and I blew a .30. Now, that's pretty high. I mean, that's really high. In fact, the probation officer told me that that was the highest they'd seen all year. This is in 1990. I was like, oh, that's nice. So they made me stay 2 days in the jail. because they wanted to see if I'd hit the car somewhere, or somebody reported some jerk hitting them. And I got harassed by the women cops more than the men cops. I hadn't eaten in 2 days, so the urine sample looked like water. They wanted me to do a blood test. I was like, absolutely not. And they threw me in this jail cell with about 40 other men right next to me. And can you imagine what happened there? They're all up on the gate next to me, catcalling, whistling, blah, blah, blah. This all happened for, like, all day, waiting to get in front of the judge. So I get in front of the judge. It's a woman who actually lost her son to a drunk driver. And that goes on my fourth step, too. So she gives me 30 AA meetings, which was high back then, and all kinds of outpatient treatment that you have to pay for. I got a probation officer, and I was scared to death. I had no idea that I was an alcoholic. I drank alcoholically, but I did not know that I was an alcoholic. So I go to the rooms. Never been to an AA room, never heard about, I mean, I heard about it, but I didn't know anybody who was in it. So I went in the back of the room and I brought some magazines with me, which I thought was really stupid. But I have to say that the women in that program really, really saved my ass, because back then, the cell phones were like this big, so you gave out pieces of paper for phone numbers and stuff, and they gave, like, six women came up to me and gave me pieces of paper with phone numbers, and they wouldn't let me go by myself to a meeting. They would take me to a meeting. They took me to meetings all over Los Angeles. They took me out to eat because I wasn't eating. I was very much in fear, and I kept asking them, am I really an alcoholic? You know, I work every day. I'm good at my job. And they finally said to me, will you fucking stop asking me if you're an alcoholic or not? Just listen. Just accept. And go to page 449, or 417, right? So I listened. I kept my mouth shut, and I started to get it. I started to understand what these 12 steps are all about. I got a sponsor, and I have to say I'm not a very good sponsor picker, because this one was, she took me to some place in Palm Springs that they were having a 12-step conference thing, but it was also the golf tournament there. So they dropped me, and I didn't see him all weekend, she and her friends. And I thought, what kind of sponsor is this? So I dumped her, and she came up to me a few weeks later and said, oh, Lee, I want to apologize. I want to make amends. And I start to say, thank you. She goes, stop, and turns around and walks away. And I thought, is that how you make amends? I'm like, that's fucked up. So I got another sponsor who, I got up to the fourth step, and I'm doing the fifth step. I'm reading with her and telling her my story, and she was, like, really popular, you know, really cool, get her for a sponsor. I'm like, oh, cool, she said yes to me. And I'm reading my fourth step to her, and she stops me, and she goes, you know what, I think you need another sponsor. I can't handle what you're telling me. I was like, oh, my God, what is this? Maybe I should get out of AA, you know. Obviously, I pushed a button in her that she couldn't deal with. So I waited till I came to San Francisco to get another sponsor. I thought maybe LA doesn't do it right or something, but you know, that's not true. I'm really glad I got sober in LA. And I moved up here when I had 3 years sober. And it was way different. You always say, you know, where you got sober is the right place. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying. I'm just saying that it was different, and I had to get used to it. But I, you know, there's this one story I wanted to tell you, and I'm just going to backtrack a little bit. I got time. This is one of the things that I like to share when I do share or speak is about spirituality. I have a feeling that a lot of people forget about spirituality. I always tell my sponsees about, you know, it's emotional recovery, physical recovery, and spiritual recovery. And when I was in L.A., right after I got arrested and stuff, and was looking for sponsors, looking for meetings, this person that I was involved with left. So here I am, and I don't know if you can remember your bottom, but most people choose their bottom. I obviously did not choose my bottom. The judge chose my bottom for me. So, and I stuck. And the thing is, I was ready. I was so in fear, as I said before, and so ready to, like, give up on my life. I lost my car. I couldn't get to work. It was just horrible. And I got on my knees, and I started praying to God. And, like, 20 pounds went off my shoulders. And I felt like, yeah, I am an alcoholic. And I don't know if you can remember when you actually felt that. What a relief, right? What a relief to admit that you're an alcoholic and that you don't have to do what you did for years and years and years. And, but at that time, I was pretty much in fear, as I've repeated 3 times. And I decided I was going to kill myself. You know, I've never done that before. I was really, really depressed. Obviously, I haven't done it before. That's my ghost, you see. And the person that I was with was going out for New Year's Eve. I remember it was right before New Year's Eve. So, leaves, and I'm thinking, okay, you know what? I'm done. I'm done with my life. I don't know what to do with myself. I'm going to get a razor and cut my wrist and go into the bathroom, into the bathtub, right? I was serious. I was really serious. I get this phone call as I'm deliberating how I'm going to do this. And it's my brother in L.A. And he says to me, you know what? Our mom, she just called me and said she had a really bad dream. Now, she was visiting my grandfather in Florida. She had a nightmare the night before. She calls my brother, and her dream was that I had killed myself. So she just happened to call him, and he happened to call me just at that time. And he talked me out of it. And I thought, my God, that's a higher power looking up at me. Somebody wants me to stay alive. The connection there, the psychic connection, was really kind of overwhelming. And I've had spiritual things like that throughout my sobriety. I think it's really important that you get a sponsor and pick the right one. If you're not sure, talk to somebody else. I think the steps are vital. I have my sponsees, and I myself have done the steps over and over and over again. I think giving back to the community is very, very helpful. I'm always looking to help out newcomers, people who have early sobriety, people in need. Some people have 20 years. A friend of mine just had 20 years and he went out. And all this time, he wasn't drinking, but guess what he was doing? Meth. And going to meetings. And I thought, wow, this is really weird to me. I would talk about humility and humbleness. When I go into a meeting, I want to make sure I'm clean and sober. Even if it's only been like a few days like you guys. At least respect the other people that are around. But I've talked to him and I understand what he was doing, but he changed his date and he's now doing a lot of NA and AA. So I help people who have time as well. We all have a hard time every once in a while, and the struggles that we go through, we really need to be there for other people. And I make sure I do that. I give back to the community in other ways. I'm now the chair of, I don't know if you guys know what Living Sober is, but it's a conference for LGBT people. And as much as I don't like it, principles before personalities, right? It's really like a meeting every day. And I still go to like 4 or 5 meetings a week because I don't want to have to go out there and drink or do drugs because I can't deal with something in my life. If you can't, you get your hand up in the air and you share about it. And I know that's really hard for people. That was hard for me in the beginning since I was so scared. But I got such support and such good feedback from everybody in the room. If it weren't for those women, I'd probably be dead by now. Seriously. Because I got put here. And I stuck around. Let's see, sponsees. It's helpful to get sponsees. It gets you out of your head. The committee stops for a while, right? That committee that's going, I got one. I don't know about you guys. But it goes on and on and on. And if you have a sponsee, you're teaching yourself as well as teaching someone who's brand new. Or not brand new.
You can take as much or as little as you want.
I'm running out.
Okay. You can run out.
Actually, you know what? I brought something to read for you guys. I just want to say that, now that everybody's leaving. bye. If it hadn't been for that judge making me go to 30 meetings, I would not be alive today. I probably would have hit somebody, or somebody would have hit me, because of course you have to drive in LA, right? You can't get anywhere unless you drive. Here, you can get on a bus or take Uber or whatever that stuff is. But I'm telling you, I would not be here today. So I have something I want to read to you guys, and then I'm probably done. It's a little excerpt from 24 Hours a Day. Does this book look familiar to people?
Mm-hmm.
Cool. If you can take your troubles as they come, if you can maintain your calm and composure amid pressing duties and unending engagements, if you can rise above the distressing and disturbing circumstances in which you are, sorry, I haven't got my glasses, in which you are set down, you have discovered a priceless secret of daily living. Even if you are forced to go through life weighed down by some unescapable misfortune or handicap, and yet live each day as it comes with poise and peace of mind, you have succeeded where most people have failed. You have wrought a greater achievement than a person who rules a nation. And that, to me, sums up what AA is all about. And thank you all for listening. I appreciate it.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.